Okay, well, I can introduce the date. It is Yom Yerushalayim today on the 10th of May, 2021. And again, we hope for good in Jerusalem overnight and tomorrow. A few things I want to share before we continue in the book. This is the 48th class. Because Nachum Shmaryahu sent me very, very long emails, the guy knows an enormous amount. Let me at least deal with that. We spoke about, he's a Chabadnik, and we spoke about Chabad. And one of the things I quoted was Rabbi Rappaport. He mentioned that Chabadnikim don't generally listen to what the Rebbe said, that the Rebbe said you have to tear Kriya. When you see, even today, the cities of the old cities from Eretz Yisrael. So why is that? So Rav Nachum Shmaryahu says to me that, first of all, he says what I said, that the Rebbe didn't always make a big deal of his halachic matters. Often there are private hora'ot, private rulings. And also he says that sometimes people just don't listen. And even in Chabad, that he quotes the Gemara, that if someone does something, does an Avera, and then does it again, it becomes natural. So, but he does say that there are Chabadnikim who, when they go to the Kotel, they borrow shirts or do other ways to get out of it, but that's not dealing with the issue of the cities. He points out as well that we spoke about Rabbi Leiter from Pittsburgh. He says Rabbi Leiter was one of the few old-time Rabbanim who has many frum kids and descendants. That's noteworthy. He also pointed out that Solomon Freehoff helped him financially in publishing his works and in supporting a kosher hospital. So he had a reason for being happy with him. Shmaryahu also says, I spoke about Telz, how Telz was one of the extreme yeshivas. They didn't allow you to go to college, whereas in Europe, they were more liberal. Because they had a gymnasium. And Nachum Shmaryahu says that Telz and Lita only had general studies program in high school, not past that stage. And in Cleveland, they also have secular studies in high school in the Mechina. So there's not much difference between Cleveland and Lita. And I say absolutely not. In Lithuania, the equivalent today of going to university was to have a gymnasium. No one had a gymnasium. That was thought to be unacceptable. That's for the moderners to have it. The fact that Telz in the middle of Lithuania would have a high school with secular studies, that is not parallel to America. Yeshivas having high schools, every yeshiva has English, even the Satmar have secular studies. So the equivalent would be today having like a college program like Ner Yisrael. And I've made the claim many times that Ner Yisrael is much more a continuation of the traditional Lithuanian approach than a place like Lakewood, because at least how Lithuania had become by, let's say, 1930. He mentions about Rav Gifter learned in Reitz for more than 6 months, but he left at a young age. And he thinks also that he was only in the high school division. So thank you for all of that, Nachum Shmaryahu. The last thing he mentioned was I had said that, talked about how anti-Zionist Chabad is. They were opposed to the creation of a state. And he says that's all true. But there's a problem in that right at the end, when they're having the UN vote, we know that the Rayatz, the previous Rebbe, wishes Shazar, who came to America, well, the vote will go in accordance with the way you want it. So what's going on here? And it isn't clear. He sends a very long email giving all the sources about this. And what he concludes is, I think maybe what I would have concluded, that at the end of the day, 1948, after the Holocaust, the British were clearly not interested in helping the Jews and letting anyone in to Palestine. It came down to that this was the least worst choice. So that in theory, it's true that he opposed the state. And after the state was declared, he says that my attitude towards Zionism has not changed in the slightest. It was pikuach nefesh. And therefore, in the end, he too came around to saying, well, it's better to have a state than not. So thank you for all of that, Rav Nachum Shmaryahu. Next thing, I said something about Meiron. Actually, let me get back to about someone asked me about David's grave. why am I so sure that David's not buried there? Well, quite apart from the fact that all the early sources, this is a Christian site that Jews later latch onto, there's an explicit pasuk. Here it is in 2 Kings chapter 2. Where is it? Yes, here it is. In verse 10, it tells you explicitly David is buried in Ir David, in the city of David. So I saw that there's some from guy who writes, well, they must have moved David. They must have moved his burial place up to Har Zion, which, of course, there's no source for that. And there's no reason to say that other than the fact that there's this tradition that he's buried there. But the Tanakh is clear where he's buried. Now, I did see that a scholar once from the early 20th century or late 19th century, he suggests that what you have in Har Zion is actually the burial places of Malchei Beis David, that is the Davidic kings. They were buried there. And because the Davidic kings were buried there, somehow David's name got associated with it as well. But David certainly is not buried here. Now, as for Meron, I listened again to my talk, and I wasn't exact what I said. What I said was that I was speaking about how the graves in the Galil that they identify with these rabbis are very recent. And then I said that Meron identified with Rashbi doesn't go back very far. Now, I was thinking, I was thinking like the Rav Avadia Bar Tanura mentions it already. So I was thinking like 400 years or something as opposed to 2000 years. The celebrations and all that go back like to the Ari's time. The Chasam Sofer already mentions how upset he is with these celebrations. He doesn't think they're in accord with Halacha to create a new holiday. Rabbi Abergel from Morocco, who we spoke about a few times, he came out last week saying that the ceremonies that they have, if you've watched these ceremonies where they light the bonfires, the Biana Rebbe is the first one and everyone lights, it's hard to look at that and not see this as akin to like a fire worship. It's, if you know how the ancient pagans would use fire in their rituals, I always thought that. I'm not going to say it's publicly like that where Abergel says. He says it's Avodah Zarah. But if you don't know what I'm talking about, take a look at some of these fire ceremonies that they do and ask yourself what this has to do with Torah Judaism. And as I said, you get the sense that this is sort of like some sort of pagan fire worshiping. I'm not exact in what I said about how far Meron is identified with Rashbi. And let me tell you why. And there's an article in Tarbitz by Avraham Yari. What I was thinking of was the following, but it's not complete. So, for instance, Benjamin of Tudela, he comes to the land of Israel around 1170, and he goes to Meron, and he talks about the graves that are in Meron. And who does he mention? He mentions the Talmidim, okay, Binyamin Bar Yafet, Rabbi Yehuda ben Batira, and he also mentions the big ones, Hillel and Shammai. Mentions nothing about Rashbi. So I knew that, Binyamin of Tudela. And also Petachia of Regensburg, he's another traveler. He also goes to Meron. Doesn't mention anything about Rashbi. Mentions Hillel and Shammai. So in my recollection, I was thinking, so there's no identification, but it's not 100% accurate because we have another traveler. They still have the Hillel and Shammai, but they've been overtaken by Rashbi because of the Zohar, the significance. We have another traveler from the same period. I don't know how to explain this. That his name is Jacob and Netano HaKohen. He does mention that there is a, he says there's a yeshiva of Rashbi, and in the yeshiva, there's a marker for Rashbi and his son. So I know that one scholar has claimed that all this begins with the yeshiva, not Rashbi, and therefore then they identify Rashbi as being buried there. But I don't know how to explain how two of the travelers don't even mention Rashbi, and one does mention it, that where the yeshiva is, that's where he's buried. So the tradition, although it's not a mainstream, perhaps, tradition, and it wasn't well known. Otherwise, when Binyamin of Tudela mentions all the graves, he would have mentioned Rashbi. But you do have a mention there, and anyone interested could read. There's a whole article by Yari, Toldos HaHilula B'Meron, the whole history of the Hilula. Now I want to show you something. I have two more things I want to show you. I didn't want to show you last week just because we were sort of like a bit of a loot last week. But we spoke in a previous class about disputes in the yeshivas. spoke about this a number of times when we dealt with Gadol Yisrael. I'm going to show you something now, just because I think you should know. It's going to be shocking. I don't know how this could happen, how this could take place. It's to put it bluntly, it's a disgrace. And I don't care if the people with the black pants and the white shirt, they could have three pairs of tzitzis hanging out. This is the furthest thing from a Torah Jew, what I'm going to show you now. And you should see it, though, because you should know what's going on and what happens when you put people, everyone, into yeshiva, even people who don't belong there, but they have no other lifestyle choice because otherwise they'll have to go to the army. They end up being there. There's big disputes going on in the Ponovej Yeshiva for years now. There even was a stabbing. I want to show you what's on the video. You see this. This is all in Israel. They all know about this. And tell me, I can't imagine for the life of me we'd ever have anything like this in America, ever. But I got a few videos. Let me start with the worst. Here you're looking at the Beis Medrash. They have these fights always. Who controls the Beis Medrash? If it's going to be the different groups, the Kahaneman group and the other group. Now, where my pointer is, and you'll see this later, is one of the opponents of the other side. You're going to see now what happens when Rabbi Kahaneman, grandson of the founder, I believe he's a grandson, not great-grandson, comes up to Davin and what the other side does to him. And he's one of the leaders of the yeshiva, but from the opposing side. Who could act like this? Oh, actually, let me, I need to make sure I share the sound here with you. So let me close this again now and give it sound, because you definitely need to hear the sound. Take a look at this. What they were showing you was the other rabbi looking on and seeing what happened. Now, what happens? Here is the picture of when they brought this Rabbi Kahneman out, injured, and watch how these menuvolim dance and rejoice that what they did to the other Rebbe. He went to the hospital. And finally, one other thing, in the main Beis Medrash, look what you see here. The two sides. They should be very proud of themselves. Okay, we don't need to see any more of that, but it's unbelievable that this is what's going on in the huge yeshiva, that the fist fights and attacking the rebbes, the leaders of the other yeshiva. It's beyond, it's moved way beyond what it was 15 years ago when all they do was throw kugel at each other in the dining room. But one day someone's going to be killed, unfortunately. The last thing I want to show you, and this is what I promised last week. Don't ask me where I'm going to. I got some the document I'm going to show you. It deals with machitzas. Okay, we spoke about Rabbi Soloveitchik and his attitude that he would give permission for rabbis to take a shul without a machitza for a year or two. And a lot of people know this as Rav Soloveitchik's view. And I said already, it's not just Rav Soloveitchik's view to take a non-machitza shul to try to get it have a machitza. I mentioned someone was skeptical, but here it is. And Rabbi Emanuel Feldman, hardly a liberal, comes from Ner Yisrael, in his book Tales Out of Shul. He writes on page 27 and 28 and on about when he was in shul, when he took this shul, it did not have a machitza, but it had separate seating. This is something that wasn't that common, but you did have shuls that had separate seating, men and women. And he says that it was, he took it after consulting with a number of rabbinic authorities. I'm assuming one was Rabbi Ruderman, who approved the arrangement on the understanding that it's temporary and that in a reasonable time, halachically acceptable partition would be installed. I believe it's already, they didn't put the machitza in to the third year. So that's one source. One day, it would be an interesting project to put a list of all the people who served in these shuls. Now, the we mentioned the movement, which we know as, where is it here? The traditional movement. I have the picture here somewhere. Here. This is Rabbi Regensburg, Slobodka Talmud, one of the leaders in the yeshiva in Skokie. He was the spiritual leader of the traditional movement. What the traditional movement was not like Rav Soloveitchik, where Rav Soloveitchik, obviously Rav Regensburg thought you should put a machitza in also, but these shuls, they didn't want machitzas. His attitude was give him an Orthodox rabbi, keep him in the fold, and these rabbis could stay there for 20 years. He didn't believe in pushing so hard. He believed that you do what you can, but you don't want to declare these shuls like Rabbi Soloveitchik did, you know, puzzle shuls, and all the Rav would do is for a temporary time send someone. Rabbi Regensburg was more tolerant. And in the popular mind, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, he comes in and he's very opposed to the traditional movement, which he is. But a lot of people assume that Rav Aaron Soloveitchik had a completely different approach than Rabbi Soloveitchik. But before we get to that, so Rabbi Regensburg saw it as he wouldn't put these restrictions, go for a couple of years. He thought it's always better to have an Orthodox rabbi in these shuls. And they formed a movement, traditional, which only lasted a generation and a half or so. But let me give you some other examples. Masoras Moshe, volume 3, page 367. Someone calls and asks for Moshe, could he be a rabbi in a shul without a machitza? Here too, though, with the story was where the women sat separately. And what does Rav Moshe say? If there's, you have a hope and a thought that within a year or two, you can convince them to put a machitza in, take the rabbonos, if you wish. And so you see, Rav Moshe Feinstein held the exact same position as Rav Soloveitchik. It's not clear whether Rav Moshe would have held even if they were mixed seating, but that wasn't the case here. But in almost all these shuls, they were mixed seating. Very few of them were separate seating. But here's the kicker, the Chazon Ish. This is from the book by Rabbi Zilberstein. It's called Mea Shearim, pages 189 to 190. Now, we've seen in the past that with Rabbi Zilberstein, you have to be very careful in his stories. To put it bluntly, he's a little bit like, although he's one of the great Gedolim in Eretz Yisrael, one of the great poskim, he's a bit like, or more than a bit like, Rav Yudah Rosenberg. That is, he tells tall tales. He tells stories, which are clearly not true. And I have a whole theory. We spoke in the past why he makes these stories up. Sometimes he makes the stories up. But in this case, it's different because he's quoting from his father-in-law, Rav Yoshev, in Rav Yoshev's lifetime. But here's the story. He was asked the question, a Talmud Chacham was asked to be rabbi in a shul without a machitza. Can he take it? And he quotes the sources, of course, that you need a machitza. But then he says, if, however, the rabbi can influence it to make a machitza, perhaps it is permissible. And he says, they asked my father-in-law, Rav Yoshev. Now, Rabbi Zilberstein makes up stories and gives stories to give a mussar lesson, that sort of thing. He tells stories about Gedolim, which he changes things, but that he doesn't make up halachas. It's sort of like Rav Yudah Rosenberg a bit. He says, that they asked this question to my father-in-law, Rabbi Elyashiv, and Rabbi Elyashiv said that Rabbi Huttner asked the Chazon Ish this question. Remember, in the 50s and 60s, when Rabbi Huttner was here, this was a big question. And the Chazon Ish replied that if the rabbi thinks that within a year he can convince them to b'mechitza in, he should take the Rabbonus. And my father-in-law said that the rabbi should make clear that I'm doing this with the intent to fix it. And Rabbi Zilberstein says that perhaps what's the idea about a year? Because there's sources that speak about it's considered temporary before it's a year. Now, in case you're one thinking, well, maybe this isn't exactly, maybe this something got lost in the reporting. How could the Chazon Ish have said that? Let me now tell you, and we'll end with this, what Rabbi Hanan Balk of Cincinnati told me, because this is a real case. The case is as follows. I'm just going to read to you what he says. Rabbi David Spetner, Rosh Kol in Cincinnati, was sitting Shiva in Yerushalayim. Ezra Hartman, the son of Rabbi Yecheskel Hartman, whose father was a rabbi in St. Louis, where Rabbi Spetner and I are both from, told him that his father took a shul there without a machitza, and it eventually had one installed. Rav Hartman asked Rav Huttner if he could take the shul. Rav Huttner asked the Chazon Ish if he could take the shul. The Chazon Ish permitted it. How do we know that such a story is to be true? Because Ezra Hartman heard it from Rav Kreisworth of Antwerp, who told him that he was the shaliach sent from Rav Huttner to the Chazon Ish. The very story that Rav Zilberstein tells from Rav Huttner happened with people we know who it happened to. And the final thing I want to show you, there's one more thing. Everyone says that Rav Aaron Soloveitchik was more strict than the Rav on this matter. That Rav Aaron, because he does, he comes to Chicago and he has a battle against when he takes over Skokie, he battles against the traditional movement and he changes the culture. But he really wasn't different from the Rav. I'm going to show you something now, which I cut out the names, but and don't ask me, like I said, where I got this document from. One day I'm going to write my, this summer, soon, the summer for me starts in 2 weeks, I'm going to start really working on my new book, The Halachic History of the United States. Maybe Canada too. I don't know. It's like Agudas Rabbanim, they call it Agudas Rabbanim of the United States and Canada. So I maybe Canada as well. And I'm going to have to deal with at length the issue of the machitza. Well, when Rav Aaron comes to Skokie, hold on, let me get rid of this. This is in the middle here. He makes a pledge. Now, what you're not seeing here is a document I'm not showing in which one of the students of Skokie who agreed, who signed this document, went ahead and took a position at a shul without machitza, without the permission of Rav Aaron and without any of the restrictions. And Rav Aaron writes a very strong letter to this shul saying that you should not take this rabbi as a rabbi, because even though you don't believe in a machitza, he's not an erelich person, because he signed a pledge and he didn't follow through on it. So even though you want a rabbi, an Orthodox rabbi, for a non-machitza shul, nevertheless, he's not the right one. So here it says, this is what everyone had to sign when Rav Aaron was a Rosh Hashiva. I hereby affirm my pledge to refrain from accepting a position in a congregation whose practices do not conform to strict Orthodox Jewish practice throughout the ages, such as mixed seating and the like. If a congregation is ready to promise it will install a machitza within a year, I may accept a position in this congregation, but not until I have discussed the specifics of the situation with Rabbi Soloveitchik, who will set certain guidelines for my own personal conduct. And here is a copy of the letter signed. I whited out or read it out here, the name of the rabbi who signed this. The original was in Hebrew. This is what Rav Aaron sent to the synagogue I'm referring to, in which this person signed it and said, exactly what we just mentioned, that that Rav Aaron would, you can take a shul like this, but only for a year, and only if Rav Aaron gives you permission. And look at number three, that until a machitza is set up, I will not participate in services in a state of commingling of genders. That's what Rabbi Soloveitchik told Riskin to do, but the Rav never told, as far as I know, never told any other rabbi to do that, because the rabbi's up on he's sitting up by the Aron Kodesh. He's not mixing with anyone. There's no women sitting next to him, but Rav Aaron is, at least in this matter, a little more strict than the Rav. But the idea that Rav Aaron Soloveitchik was opposed to the Rav's position that you couldn't even temporarily take a shul without machitza is not true. But you had to do it. I don't know if the Rav also never gave 1 year exact. I think it would depend. He said, I think he would tell people after a year, contact me again. He might extend it for another year or whatever. Maybe Rav Aaron would do that as well. I don't know. You have to speak to people who took those positions. But here you have a document showing. And of course, if I do write, finish this, if I do write the chapter of the history, the whole history of America, and I deal with the issue of the machitza, I'll discuss it in more detail and what I just showed you. Now we move on to the book. We are on page 346, Simon Kuf Samech Gimel. And I don't have a picture, so I can't introduce you to this person, but by face. We're dealing with someone whose name is Rav Mordechai Spielman. Not the most famous person. I don't know if anyone listening has heard of him. Well, I know at least a couple have, because when I mentioned him last week, someone emailed me. I said that his Sfarim are among the most significant not to be on Otzer HaChachma. It's rare to find not to find Sfarim on Otzer HaChachma. What did he write? Well, first of all, he wrote 7 volumes of this work. Tiferes Tzvi on the Zohar. This is a work by Rabbi Spielman. Incidentally, Rabbi Spielman comes from Munkach, and he's a Munkach or Chassid. But although he's a Munkach or Chassid, in Scranton, I was his nephew was my Chavrusa, and his nephew told me, and then his son confirmed that later on, that he would celebrate Thanksgiving. That was how grateful he felt to America that he celebrated Thanksgiving. When I do write my book, The Lach History of America, one of the points I'll make is that, let's say, before the war, this was after the war, as Spielman did, but before World War II, like the interwar years, where you had lots of rabbanim in America, the idea that anyone would have a problem with Thanksgiving, all these issues at Camp Lader, it would have been unimaginable. It wasn't even, as we say in Talmudic language, a hava mina. But Rabbi Spielman celebrated it every year. And he wrote this. This is called A Commentary on the Zohar. And it has haskamas from all the big Gedolim, American Gedolim and others, including the Bujava Rebbe. I've never seen haskama. I once davened with the Bujava Rebbe in Borough Park when I was went on a Shabbaton when I was in elementary school. I didn't see him, though. The Bujava Rebbe stayed upstairs. He davened by himself. But the Bujava Rebbe is the figure. He's the center figure in Yaffa Eliach's Tales of the Holocaust. He was a very holy man. But he wasn't a posek or anything. So when you look at the Haskamas, it's Rabbi Kamenetsky, Rabbi Yonason Steif, Rav Ruderman, Rabbi Yitzhak Yaakov Weiss, Rav Futner, Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Shlomo Zalman Abrach, Rav Vosner, and then the Bujava Rebbe. So that's but it's called A Commentary on the Zohar. And the last volume that came out posthumously, so you can get on Amazon in soft cover, but it's really not a commentary. What it is, it's like one of these books that it's a jumping off point to discuss everything under the sun. Incredible bukios Rabbi Spielman has. He also wrote another book. So that's 7 volumes. I have 5 of the 7 volumes. I wish it was on Otzer HaChachma because I don't have volume 1 and another volume. And then he has this book, Tzion LeNefesh Tzvi. And this book is the thick book, is the largest treatment about Kohanim going to the graves of Tzaddikim. We know that Kohanim are not allowed to go to the graves of to graves. However, there's a whole tradition that Kohanim are allowed to go to the graves of Tzaddikim. Actually, I'm surprised that Chabad hasn't adopted this, because when I went to the Rebbe's grave, it's clear that Kohanim don't go there, but there's a whole tradition. So for instance, in Eretz Yisrael, the tradition always was, at least among the Sardim, that Kohanim would go to Kever Rachel. That was the tradition. And this isn't something made up. And you have a whole sefer dealing with this. There is, because the righteous are thought not to give off tuma, impurity. So a whole sefer in that. So why am I writing to Rabbi Kunitz? Well, because in his book, volume 1, actually, which I don't have here, but I've gone through it, Tiferet Tzvi, he deals with the commentator, the author, Tzioni. And before I tell you about what the Tzioni says, the Tzioni is 15th century, I have to tell you about another story. because Sioni is commenting on this. And that's the famous commentary, the Perush of Rabbi Yehuda Chassid. And the whole controversy about that, you can, Torah in Motion, you can listen to Schneer Lyman's talk about it. But here, Rabbi Yehuda Chassid, the great, one of the leaders of medieval Ashkenaz, one of the Hasidic Ashkenaz, the 12th century, early 13th century, he has a commentary on the Torah that appeared, only was published in the 20th century, although we have citations of it earlier. And he writes in his commentary some unusual things, among which that there are, in a number of places, he points out that there are post-Mosaic additions, either put in by Yoshua, Anshei Knesset HaGedola, into the Torah. Now, one of them that he points out, gives an example, is this verse here. Is this, not just a verse, a whole section. Beginning in Genesis 36, beginning in verse 31. These are the kings that reigned in the land of Edom before there reigned any king over the children of Israel. Lifnei Melach Melach Livnei Yisrael. And he says that from this verse on until the end of the chapter, this is all post-Mosaic. Ibn Ezra already quotes someone who says this, and Ibn Ezra rejects this. So you have to understand, what does it mean, king of Israel? You could say that refers to Moshe, but the pshat apparently would be, it means king. But so therefore, you could say it's anachronistic because, you know, there wasn't any king yet. There wasn't even a concept of a king till the days of Shmuel. That's what Yehuda Chassid says. By the way, he's not the only one to say this. What we deal with for Moshe Feinstein, this is before many other, we now have a number of commentaries from medieval Ashkenaz, Rav Elazar of Worms as well, and a number of others that say, also say this position. But Moshe Feinstein was asked about this. He was asked by one of the rabbis in Zurich, because the person who published this, his name was Yitzhak Lange, as a Talmud Chacham. He was an expert in publishing Rishonim, and he showed it to the rabbi, and the rabbi sent it to Rav Moshe. And Rav Moshe said that this is heresy, and it has to be, Rav Yehuda Chassid couldn't have written it, and therefore you can't sell the book. It has to be removed from circulation. Now, Rav Moshe Feinstein says many times about passages, including my next blog post, he says about a passage in Rashi on the Gemara, that this can't be written by the individual. He says it about Rashi. He says it about Ramban. He says it about Orach Chaim. He says it about Rashbam. He says it about Rav Yaakov Emden. He says it about Rav Yaakov Emden. We even have the manuscript of Rav Yaakov Emden, his own manuscript. Number of people have written about this. Rav Moshe has a tendency to say numerous times about texts that have been in circulation for 1,000 years, and everyone has talked about it. Everyone has commented on it. Rishonim, Achronim, the author couldn't have written it. Now, how can you say such a thing? It has been suggested that Rav Moshe couldn't have meant it seriously, because he's saying about the Ma'arit. I mean, it's over and over again. It's been suggested that when Rav Moshe says that Rabbi X, Gadol Posek X, couldn't have said this, it must have been put in by a mistaken student or something else, he didn't really mean it. That is just a respectful way of Rav Moshe saying that I reject what this author, like when he says Rav Yaakov Emden couldn't have said it, he never could have said it. He's not really saying Rav Yaakov Emden say it, but it's a respectful way of saying that this is really way off, totally wrong. And rather than saying Rav Yaakov Emden doesn't know what he's talking about here, you say that he couldn't have said it. The Menashe Klein, when he rejects Rav Moshe on what we're going to speak about now, he himself says Rav Moshe couldn't have said it. And there it's clear. Menashe Klein knows Rav Moshe said it. Rav Moshe published it. It is a respectful way. And we do have examples where people say that. I don't know if this is what Rav Moshe means. He definitely does not mean it in this case with Rav Yehuda Chassid. But you should know that Rav Moshe says lots of times that it couldn't. He says Rashi couldn't have said it. Rashi couldn't have said it? Rav Moshe said it's heresy. It goes against the Rambam's principle that you can't have post-Mosaic authorship. What's Rabbi Yehuda Chassid's position and the other medieval Ashkenazic authorities? We don't know. Chaim Soloveitchik has a piece on this where he says that people might have thought in medieval Ashkenaz this is eccentric, but it's not heretical. Now, why not? Because this is what I think. If you look in the Mishnah, or the Gemara, what does it say? It says, everyone, Kol Omer, anyone says that Moshe said a pasuk on his own, that's heresy. It seems they understood these verses. And remember, the Gemara itself already says that the last Pesukim in the Torah are written or post Mosaic. It seems that they understood it as follows, that if you say that Moshe wrote it on his own, that's what's heretical, because you turn Moshe into a fraud. Moshe's saying that this is from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but he really wrote it on his own. That's the issue. But if you assume it's written prophetically, then that's what's the difference? If Moshe wrote it, if Yeshua wrote it on Shekinah Sadoah, it seems to be that's how they understand it. And Rav Shlomo Fischer from Itri, the great Rav Shlomo Fischer, who's such a significant figure, he said when he was shown what Rav Moshe wrote, he said that Rav Moshe assumes that Rav Yehuda Chassid has to accept the Rambam's 13 principles, but he doesn't have to accept the Rambam's 13 principles. And in this case, he didn't. It's of interest that Otzer HaChachma, which is the great repository of all the Sfarim, in the old editions of Otzer HaChachma, they what happened was, because of the response of Rav Moshe, they took out these passages, these so-called critical passages, and they published a second edition of Rav Yehuda Chassid. So if you see an edition of Rav Yehuda Chassid, you have to know where it is. So I can tell you, for instance, that as I recall, the Harvard copy is the censored edition, but the Brandeis copy is the full edition, or vice versa. I forget now, because I was in both those places. Rav Moshe thought the whole commentary should be banned, because he says, who knows what else is in there, but that was the compromise they made. And that's what used to appear, the censored version of Otzer HaChachma. However, if you look on Otzer HaChachma right now, if you go on it right now, you'll see that they have the complete, the uncensored version. Everything on Otzer HaChachma, it's not like HebrewBooks.org, everything on Otzer HaChachma is rabbinically approved. They won't put anything in there from Maskilim or anything like that. There has clearly been a change of opinion, because the old Otzer HaChachma only had the censored one. The new Otzer HaChachma has the passages. And I think the reason they have it is because we now have a number of Rishonim who cite this, these ideas. Rav Avigdor Katz. And as I said, and therefore they've decided that this is acceptable. Also, there's a new Mikros Gedolos Chumash. It's called Otzer HaRishonim. And it also cites the same passages that Rav Moshe said are absolutely out of bounds. That's not all Rav Yehuda Chassid says. He also says, commenting on this pasuk, and this is what we're going to deal with, Sioni. Commenting on this pasuk Bamidbar, Perek Chafalath Yud Zayin. Az Yashir Yisrael es Hashira Azos. Then sang Israel this song. So the pshat is that the song is what comes right next. But Rabbi Yehuda Chassid, and not just Rabbi Yehuda Chassid, Rabbi Avigdor Katz says that what this Shira is Halo Hagadol, what we call chapter 136. If you read it, Hodu Hashem, it's he who smote Egypt, he who overthrew Pharaoh, Sichon, Og, all the rest. And that this was removed from the Torah, he says, by King David and put into Tehillim. I mean, this is a little wild. What's King David doing removing a chapter, and who gave him the authority? But that's what he claims. And not only that, all the anonymous Psalms as well were originally in the Torah. I don't want to get into where Rabbi Yehuda Chassid gets this, and it's not his idea, because Avigdor Katz quotes it as well. There was some tradition, the origins of which we don't know. For our purposes, what's significant is Rabbi Menachem Tzioni, the 15th century Makubo, and a well-known person, a well-known Makubo, he cites this from Rabbi Yehuda Chassid, this very idea that the Halo HaGadol was removed, was originally a Torah and was removed. When Rabbi Lange from Switzerland showed this to Rabbi Levi, that was his name, I believe, from Switzerland, who then sent to Ramosha said, well, then we have to ban Sioni also, because he has a heretical thing. And Ramosha says that we don't know who this Sioni is. which people found very hard to believe that because Sione is he's important to Makubo, but I get it. You know, he's fine. He's quoting the Magid Avraham, but Ramosha's not doing Kabbalah. He's focusing on Shas and Poskim. And this is what Rabbi Spiegelman talks about in his book. He rejects Rav Moshe. He talks about the significance of Tzioni. And he gives a different interpretation, as I recall. I forget exactly what his interpretation I don't know if he mentions this passage removing the pasuk, but in terms of the post-Mosaic editions, no, sorry. He says, I think he says in his own Chumash he removed it, not in the Sefer Torah, but Moshe removed it from his own Chumash, something like that. I forget. It's not important for our purposes. I wrote to Rabbi Spielman and I asked him about this. I wanted to hear more about his position on this matter. And he talks about that where Rav Moshe Feinstein says that you can't buy the Tzioni because you have the strange views. He said, and he wrote this to Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, Rav Moshe. Rabbi Spielman says as follows, and this is a historically important point, which is only found here. He says that he speaks a bit about Tzioni and how his how all the great poskim cited Tzioni, and that he says that in the year Shin Chaf, so Tuf Shin Chaf is 1960, so that'll be 1560. The Christians burnt 1,000 in Cremona, Italy. They burnt 1,000 copies of the commentary of Tzioni on the Torah. And he goes on. He says he Rabbi Spielman thinks the reason they burnt it, what they found heretical, was that in Parshas Korach, Tzioni speaks about the Gilgal of Jesus and negative things about Jesus. But then he says that. A few years ago, when I was in Jerusalem and I visited the Posek Hador of Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, he agreed with me and said, Beferush, in front of all these great rabbis in Jerusalem, that Rav Moshe is not correct on this, that it's forbidden to sell this sefer. And he mentions that he gives an interpretation of Tzioni. So it doesn't mean, he also says that Tzioni doesn't mean literally. Like I said, I think it says it means that not the King David, that Rav Moshe, that Moshe Rabbeinu took it out in his own private chumash, he took it out. Sorry, no, so King David took it out of his private chumash or something like that, not the Sefer Torah per se, but that Moshe Rabbeinu had written this together in his chumash, not in the Torah. And it was from that, because Tzioni uses the word chumash when he means Torah. But that, I don't think that it's hard to see. I think Ramosha's right that all these look. If Rav Yehuda Chassid could say that these verses were added after Moshe Rabbeinu, why can't he say that David removed it? It's just as strange, perhaps. Rabbi Spielman doesn't deal with the post Mosaic verses. So that's the first point of interest, and that's really the accepted position today, that you can interpret it Tzioni or Yehuda Chassid differently if you want, but Ramosha's position has not been accepted in that matter. The second point I raised with him is he's quoting this work, the Ben Yochai. We saw the Ben Yochai, we spoke about it, of Rav Moshe Kunitz. Here's Rav Moshe Kunitz. He was the one, if you recall, I told you he wrote the responsum permitting using an organ played by a non-Jew on Shabbos, even though he was one of the poskim in Pesht. He wrote a book, Ben Yochai. Here, let me show you again, Ben Yochai. I showed it to you, but maybe we have new people who don't remember, or maybe people don't remember. Here's the Ben Yochai. It's... that's the Shimon Bar Yochai's cave. This is a work, has a lot to do with halacha and Kabbalah, but some of it, and the most significant part of it, is the defense of the Zohar's authenticity against Rav Yaakov Emden's criticisms. Rabbi Kunitz, his book was attacked by this individual, Shear. Rav Shlomo Yehuda Rappaport. Rav Shlomo Yehuda Rappaport was, like I said last week, he's a modern, he's a maskil, although he's the son-in-law of the Katzos HaChoshen, Rav Yehuda Peller. He's also a maskil, but he's a Rav. If he was around today, we'd call him modern Orthodox, I guess. So he's in Galicia, he's in Tarnopol, he has problems with the Hasidim there. The Chasam Sofer took a liking to him and treated him very well. And this is a big problem for the Kanoim, because Shear becomes like a big enemy of theirs. So how could, at least in Shear's youth, but this was after Shear started publishing stuff. We see he's a religious maskil. How was the Chasam Sofer so friendly with him? So Rabbi Yehuda, Yekusiel Yehuda Greenwald, who we'll speak about, I don't think today, next class, the great expert in Hungarian Jewry, he says, well, it must be that the Chasam Sofer saw that Shear was Poseach HaShnei Seipim, that he was, you know, he was had a foot in both camps, and he was afraid that we're going to lose him to the maskilim, so the Chasam Sofer had to bring him close. Maybe, it could be. Shear becomes rabbi in Prague. Prague, which was the center of Torah Judaism in the end of the 18th century with the Notabi Oda, by the middle of the 19th century, the Orthodox are a minority, and it's completely, it's like an irreligious town. The founder of the Daf Yomi, Meir Shapiro, has an essay in which it's called Pressburg and Prague, talking about how if you went to Pressburg in the end of the 18th century and you went to Prague, they were each the individual type of cities, Torah-centered cities. And you go 70 years later, what happened? Prague doesn't even have 1,000 Shomer Shabbos in the whole city. And the non-religious control the city, a big reform synagogue. You know, what's going on here? And he speaks about the fact, you know, the focus on Torah, the yeshiva, Pressburg, but the Orthodox Jews who remained in Prague and the non-Orthodox or the non-observant Orthodox, they wanted modern rabbis. So they had an election between Shear, Rappaport, and Ritzir Chayas, who was also a religious maskil, the Maritz Chayas. And Shear won, and he remained in Prague to the rest of his life, and he fought the reformers, but he's a religious maskil. He's an academic-type scholar, but he's also the Rav of the city. He published a work called Nachas Yehuda, in which he attacks Kunitz and shows that Rav Kamden is right, and that Kunitz's arguments are often ridiculous. So I wrote to Rabbi Spielman, because as you might recall, I showed you, or I mentioned to you, that in the new printings of the Mishnayos, they take out Rabbi Kunitz's essay on the biography of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. Because the rumor is that he's a reformer, Kunitz, when he's not a reformer. He was asked a question by people in Germany, and he didn't, can you play an orgy with a non-Jew? And he answered it like any other shaygo, without knowing the situation. So I write to him, I want to hear what he thinks about Rabbi Kunitz. And he says that there's nothing in the writings of Rabbi Kunitz that is heretical. Certainly, bevadai she'en l'chadesh kait. Certainly, you can't say today that it's forbidden to look in Rabbi Kunitz's writings, especially shekol gadol Yisrael hayviu devarav. All the gadolim cited Rabbi Kunitz and dealt with his stuff. And then he says that I am correct that Kunitz did not know what the reformers were like. They send him a letter. He answers the question. He didn't realize that this was just part of an effort to undermine traditional Judaism. And then Rabbi Spielman says, and it makes sense what you're saying, because Rabbi Kunitz was the student of the Notabi Yehuda. And this was at the beginning of the Reform, when people didn't know what they were like. If you recall, I said that that's not an argument, though. Because Aaron Chorin, the founder of the Reform, he also was a student of the Notabi Yehuda. That's not a good argument. But then he says, and I mentioned in my letter, the Shear, Shlomo Yehuda Rapport's Kuntres, Nachos Yehuda, he says, I wrote to him, I said that it was reprinted. It was reprinted by the Satmar, believe it or not. The Satmar had a whole printing press in the 90s before everything was online. Copy Corner, it's called. I helped them a lot. They came up to Cambridge and I helped them with the Sfarim. And he says that even though Shear, in his criticisms of the Ben Yochai, Kunitz, is correct in many times, and he says, I already wrote to you. He wrote to me a second letter, but I can't find the second letter, so I didn't publish it, that the Rav Yosef Shalom Natanson, the Sholem Meshiv, said about Kunitz, he called him a puppet, the one who just stammers. But he nevertheless says that despite that, it was a terrible thing that they printed Shear's work, because he came out publicly against many of the Gedolim, the Rishonim and Achronim, and he says it's a terrible thing, an Avla Gedola, that they reprinted Kunitz, that they reprinted Shear's work. So you see that he cites them. Spielman cites Rappaport's Nachos Yehud, but it's like we've seen. He doesn't want people today to see it. If you have it, you know it, you can read it. And that's an interesting letter, but that's the letter. The next letter, this is Simon Kuf Samach Dalid, is about the books of Rabbi Yekusiel Yehuda Greenwald, Leopold Greenwald. I couldn't find a picture of him online. I've seen a picture, but I couldn't find it online. He comes from Hungary, comes to America, a prolific writer in Yiddish and in Hebrew. He even has a diary in Yiddish of his times in the army during World War I for the Austrian-Hungarian Empire. He writes about everything, and then he comes to America. He writes on halacha. He writes on history. He wrote a book on Rav Yosef Karo. He wrote a book on the history of Shlita. And then he begins to focus on Hungary. He writes a number of works on Hungarian Orthodoxy. His book, Kolbo Alavelos, was the standard work that every rabbi had. Every pulpit rabbi, I think, a rabbi Yael, and I'm looking at you. You had Kolbo Alavelos in your rabbinate? I don't know. Yes, everyone had the Kolbo. It was any question you had about Alavelos, it was there divided into chapters. Today they have other works which are more complete, but still the Kolbo is good because it has letters of many Gedolim, and it also has questions you never would think of. By the way, at the end of his rabbinate in Cleveland, in Columbus, Ohio, first of all, there was split of the shul, and his shul forced him to have forced the matter that they took down the machitza, and he had to compromise with it. At the end of his life, he was in a shul, separate seating, but no machitza. And originally, he fought against the shul, which wanted to have no machitza, and the shul split. But then, even the shul that he was a member, a rabbi of, they wanted to go that way as well. I guess the other shul didn't have any separate seating. And there's a lot to say about Rabbi Greenwald. There's someone who might be doing even a doctoral dissertation on Rabbi Greenwald. He attacks the modern Orthodox. He's the one who, I told you this already, I don't know if I cited the name of Rabbi Greenwald. He attacks these modern Orthodox rabbis who at funerals walk in front of the coffin like the priest at the cemetery. They were reading Psalms and everything. I've noticed that at most Orthodox times that the coffin goes out first, and then the rabbi. When they get to the cemetery, the rabbi is walking behind the coffin. Maybe if the rabbis you know are walking in front of the coffin, you could tell them that that's a Christian thing. But I wrote to this rabbi. His name is Ben Sion Jakobowitz, a Satmar, Hungarian. He wrote a few volumes called Zechor Yemo Solam, very, very detailed writings on Hungarian Orthodoxy. Everything you want to know about Hungary, and we're going to talk about Hungary next class, what made Hungary unique. And I just wanted to know why he didn't cite Greenwald. And he replies to me that he refers to him respectfully. He calls her Greenwald Zichrono Livracha. I mean, he was a Zionist, Greenwald, so maybe. But he says it is true that he was the only writer, as before me, he's saying, who wrote about these matters, history of Hungarian Orthodoxy and the spirit of Orthodoxy. And when I need his sources, I cite them. However, he says, I didn't need him because I have all the sources. And these two volumes are really, they're full of information. But then he says, furthermore, he goes into great detail on side matters, such as talking about the Reform conferences. And also, he mentions the reformers by name, which of course he does. Greenwald's a real historian. If he cites, he wants to cite what Geiger said and what Horan says, he cites them by name. In this book, he won't cite them by name. And that's Simon Kuf Samach Dalet. And Kuf Samach Hey, that's when we'll start it at least now. That's when we start getting into the essence of it here. The title of it is Shitat Ahitbadrut Shel Rabbanei Hungaria. And there's the next four, and this takes us to the end of the book before the appendix. The last four letters deal with Hungarian Orthodoxy. The translation of this is the separatism, the position of separatism, what we call Austrit in Germany, of the Hungarian rabbis. There was a big, let me tell you a little bit, I'll introduce it, then we'll see it next class. Hungary, we all know, if you've been with us, these classes that in Germany, you had what's known as Austrit. You had communities that were completely separated from the non-Orthodox. So you had, say, in Frankfurt, you had a general community where you were part of the community, you paid taxes, and the community supported the Orthodox synagogue and the Reform synagogue. And the community also supported the old age home. And then you had, when the law permitted it, and what was it, 1876, I believe, or 1873, I forget, it permitted the Jews following, because the Christians were given this permission earlier, to separate from the community and make their own communities. So you no longer would have to pay taxes to the general community. And this was Shamshon Raphael Hirsch's great battle that to create a system where we no longer will be in one community. They created separatist communities. So therefore you belong to your community. And as opposed to the Grosska mind, as it's called, the larger community, you're not a member and you don't need to pay taxes there unless you want to pay taxes, as many did, because they wanted to be buried in the communal cemetery. And that was a huge dispute in Germany between Rabbi Bamberger and Rabbi Hirsch. And it continued until the war, their successors. The exact same thing happened in Hungary, except a little different. You had this, you had reformers, of course, in Hungary as well, not as radical as you had in Germany, but you had reformers. And everything came to the fore. There was a Congress called by the government. They wanted to have a Congress of all the Jews. They wanted to know who to deal with. And the Orthodox and the non-Orthodox couldn't agree. They couldn't sit together. They couldn't get along. The Orthodox wanted the non-Orthodox to agree that we're going to follow the Shulchan Aruch. And the non-Orthodox, of course, didn't agree with that. And that led to the great Taiwung, the great separation, which you had then in the last quarter, even more than the last quarter, of the 19th century in Hungary, is a division. You had what's known as the Orthodox. They took the term Orthodox. And then you had a group, the non-Orthodox, they're called the Neologues. The definition of a Neologue, if you went to the Neologue synagogue, it's like a right-wing conservative synagogue today. Men and women sat separately. The women were up in the balcony. You had an organ played by a non-Jew. But the sitters the same, but they were in doctrinal matters, they weren't as, I guess, Orthodox, and they made certain changes, but we're not dealing with like reform like you had in Germany. So, and therefore each, you could choose. You could either be part of the Orthodox or you'd be part of the Reform. And everyone had to choose. Every community would choose. And then if the community was Orthodox, you could also have a Neologue synagogue in the community, or if this community with the majority, let's say the majority of the city was Neologue, they controlled the institutions because they're the majority, they controlled the big synagogues, then you have a separatist community, and that's an Orthodox community. And what does it mean to be Orthodox? It means that it doesn't mean you're Shomer Torah Mitzvos. It means that you belong to the Orthodox organization. There was an organization in Budapest, and you were a member of this organization, and you committed yourself to be part of it. There were some Jews in Hungary, around 10%, even perhaps less, who didn't want any of this. They didn't want any of the separatism. They didn't want to be, they weren't Neologue because they're Torah observant. And they were completely, as I said, Torah observant, but they didn't want to join the Orthodox organization because they didn't want to get involved in all the fights. Let's say you're in a small village. You didn't want, also the Orthodox organization was ruled by the Ashkenaz, as they called them, the Ashkenazim, the non-Hasidim. So if you're a Hasid, you're going to be ruled by people who live in Budapest who speak Hungarian, who wear short jackets, and they spoke Hungarian in Budapest, and they were modern. Hungarian patriots. So you had people in Hungary, including Gedol Yisrael, and later on even Hasidic rabbis, who said that we don't want to be part of this Orthodox organization. And they said, we're not a member of anything. We're just continuing the way we were. We're not joining the Neologues, obviously. We're not joining the Orthodox organization. And they called themselves, they were called status quo. That is status quo ante. They're keeping the way things were. Satmar. Satmar has a status quo community there, in addition to the Satmar Rebbe's. And the rabbi of the Satmar status quo was a Talmud Chacham. He published a periodical, and all the Gedolim who contributed were from like Poland and Lithuania and Germany, because in Hungary, the status quo rabbis were regarded as outside the fold. If this is hard, and we're going to, this will be the last thing I say, but you had this break up, this breakdown between the Orthodox, Neolog, and then you had a status quo. The Orthodox rabbis declared that everyone has to join the Orthodox group because this is a melchama, this is a war between the Torah community and the non-Torah community. And those Jews who refused to join this and be part of it, you know, part of this organization, they were status quo. They were regarded by the Orthodox, and that includes many of the Gedol Yisrael, Maram Shik and others, as no different than the reformers. A status quo rabbi, a status quo shochet couldn't, were considered puzzle. And this created an enormous break. And even though you had certain Gedol Yisrael who were part of the status quo, this continued until World War II. Those who remember Budapest, I showed you, within 5-minute walk of each other in Budapest, you have the Dohani synagogue, which was the Neolog. And then you had, I showed you the status quo synagogue. And of course, the Kaczynski Shul, the Orthodox synagogue there. By the end, the status quo shuls were basically, as Rabbi Oberlander said to me correctly, he's the Chabad Rabbi in Budapest, they were the modern Orthodox. The status quo, basically, you had rabbiner doctors, the rabbis from Berlin Rabbinical Seminary, they became status quo rabbis. The old time, but they still were, you could not step foot in a status quo synagogue. It was off limits, just like a reform synagogue was off limits. And here's the great irony, I'll end with this. The Hungarian Orthodox turned to Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch and asked him to sign their declaration. This is a document that has never yet been published. One day maybe I'll publish it. It's at the Jewish Theological Seminary, as I recall, in one of the archives there. Asked Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch to sign a document. Actually, take that back. I'm sorry. I think the document I'm referring to, I found another document, but this document I'm referring to, I believe Mordechai Brewer published it, signed a document affirming Orthodoxy because he's the leader of the separatist Orthodox in Germany. And Rabbi Hirsch refused to sign it. He said that in Germany, of course we have to be separatists because these are reformers and we can't be part of them. But what's the problem with the status quo? They're Shomer Torah Mitzvos. They're no different than us. The fact that they don't join your organization, how can I put them in Cheirim for that? So Hirsch opposed the delegitimization of the status quo rabbis, who were, as I said, we're going to hear about a great one, Mayor Perlis. I'll tell you about some other ones. And so what we're going to do next class is we're going to see, I challenge Rabbi Jacobowitz with the Litvish perspective and the Polish perspective that all this separatism is no good. In Lithuania and Poland, they didn't have any separatism. And you'll hear what this Hungarian rabbi, he's also a posek, he wrote Sfarim on Halacha, has to say about me and my friends, as I call them, and how we're missing the boat. And then we're going to get into Rameir Perlis, one of the Gedol Yisrael of Hungary, who refused to join the Orthodox and remain a status quo. So it's very easy to say that status quo rabbis are apostle, but when one of the greatest Gedolim of Hungary is a status quo rabbi, what are you supposed to do? And then more about the status quo. The question is, can you learn the Torah of the status quo rabbis? And I think we'll finish up next class with a very unusual, and this will be the end of the Sefer, but then we're going to have the appendix, which will take us a class or two. There's one person in particular who wants to hear about this appendix. Wait, there's all sorts of great stuff in the appendix. Rabbi Shlomo Tzvi Shik, the subject of a master's dissertation of Adam Furziger. He was an Orthodox rabbi who was the great defender of the status quo rabbis in Hungary. And I'll tell you about this very unusual rabbi who has children and grandchildren, great-grandchildren in America. There was a Rabbi Alexander Shik. He was the rabbi of Rabbi Blech Shul, the Yorkville Shul. Rabbi Alexander Shik and his children all went to Lakewood. He's the grandson of the Rashban, who was regarded in Hungary as Michutz Lamachane because he dared to defend the status quo rabbis. So basically, as I said, the parallel would be is if they said in America, if your shul is not a member of the OU, then you are not an Orthodox shul and you are not a valid rabbi and a valid shul. That would be the equivalent of what happened in Hungary. The Maram Shik was not into so many of these things. They came up with all these decrees also. You can't have a preacher to speak in. A preacher's not allowed to speak in the vernacular and other things. And the Maram Shik says, I don't really buy this. But if the majority of rabbis go with it, I can't oppose them. So you had in Hungary, you had the extremists, like the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch was considered one of the extreme rabbis. You had Rav Hillel Lichtenstein and others. And then you had in the middle, the Maram Shik, the Ksav Sofer, and then you had on the left. When I say in the middle, because they didn't want to go along with all these decrees, especially the Ksav Sofer. He appointed a preacher in German, even though his father said no. He said times have changed. And then you had the rabbis on the left. We'll get more into this next week. I see it's already 9:35, so let me end here. About very fascinating. That's the trip I really want to return to. As soon as we can return again, we're going to go to Hungary. Rabbi Kelman hasn't been since the first trip, so he'll join us.
Right. Hopefully, yeah. Right. Please God, yes.
Yes, and Baruch, today every yeshiva is English, so he says, you're taking sides of the debate raging in New York State. I'm not taking sides. There's no sides. Every yeshiva does have English, but the Yafed people say, but it's phony English. It's hardly anything, but they have something. But you're right, the Litvish all have. Hasidim mostly have. But the Litvish yeshivas all have. Chil Hashem, yes, it's definitely a Chil Hashem what you've seen. There's no excuse. What caused the split and who's each side? It's all about who's going to take over between it goes back to the founding of the yeshiva. All these things, it's always, does it go through the son or does it go through the sons-in-law? But it's not a joke that there was a stabbing already about 4 or 5 years ago. Someone's going to be killed. Or severely, I can show you videos. I showed you in the past. They throw chairs at each other. What's going to happen, Chas HaShalom, when one day the chair hits someone in the head? You could brain damage a person like that. It's one thing when students will fight with each other. Not that that's acceptable, but to pull a rabbi's beard, to throw him around like that. Where do people get this idea that you attack the rabbis? Even in one of the machokas we spoke about, let's say when we did the classes in the Tziv, the most they would do, they threw a rock through a window of a rabbi, which I guess could kill him also, but never would actually physically attack the rabbi. The Ponovezh conflict's been going on and off. It's been going on like 20 years, 15 years. The Litvish Gedolim, it's been brought to them. There's been Din Torah, but... Aryeh Deri, of all people, the Sephardic person, said that a couple weeks ago, he said, we're going to have to bring the police in. Literally the police. But you can't, easier said than done. How can you bring the police in? What are they going to do? You can go online. You can see other videos. I've showed other videos in the past. It is incredible. I think Baruch says, look at the age of the rioters, their young faces. They don't have basketball. They don't have any fun. Everything is about... their troublemaking has to be in the yeshiva. So, they get all excited. I think it's a bit like these people in Borough Park who get so excited. This guy, Heshy Tischler, and the rest of them, the young people, they don't have any outlets and they want to feel like they're part of something. And yes, it is a bunch of behemoths. It's very sad. Justin says the Brandeis Chapel, Kabbalah Shabbat, separate, no machitza in the olden days. And JTS, in one of the shuls there, which Liebman davened in, the Unterberg Auditorium, it was separate, no machitza. You had examples like this. And the Rav was specific. He said separate seating, no machitza, is not a church, like he's davening, like he said about the others. But it wasn't very common. I want to clarify something, because someone asked me about Rabbi Soloveitchik, about this idea of not going into a shul on, I said it's Hara Shah, Rabbi Parnas said, not going into a reform shul, not going into a non-machitza shul to hear shofar. So someone said, why is it Hara Shah? It's halacha. No, it's not halacha. The halacha is you can't daven in a shul without a machitza. Where is there a halacha that you can't hear shofar if men and women are together? I can hear shofar with a woman next to me. So that's what Rabbi Parnas meant. It's Hara Shah to say, even to hear Tekiyah Shofar, you can't be in a place where men and women are together. Because that we don't have a source for. We have sources that you can't have davening, but just to hear Tekiyah Shofar. So the Rav said, so that's why Rabbi Parnas said it's Hara Shah. Um, Is Rav Regensburg's traditional Judaism unrelated to the Union for Traditional Judaism founded by Rav Loisa Livni in the 1980s? There's no relationship with this. The Union of Traditional Judaism are the right-wing conservative rabbis who opposed women's ordination in particular, as well as other things. Ironically, the Union of Traditional Judaism is more traditional than YCT in certain areas. Not in every area, but in certain areas. So that comes from and it wasn't founded by Rabbi Weiss HaLivni. It was founded by people like David Novak and a number of others, and he became what they called the Reish Matifta HaLivni. And it never really succeeded. But that's, it's unrelated. Naftali says the Midrash indicates that only 3,000 participated in the Chet Egel, but the remainder of the Am watched and did not protest. If this is going on without protest from the Klal, you're right. It's a, really, you should shut the yeshiva down. Shut it down until people can behave properly. But it's bad. Shmuel says, you've seen Lubavitcher Kohanim. He said cohabitation. Kohanim, it should be going to the Rebbe's Ohel. They walk through the cemetery with a box around them to make a mechitza, but don't use it when entering the Ohel. Okay, I didn't know that. And I know I'll hear something from Shmariyahu, from Nachum Shmariyahu, because when I went there, there are signs about, you know, Kohanim, and they told me that Kohanim are makpid and not to go to the Rebbe, but I guess not... Mark says they no longer use portable aluminum boxes. They've erected high fences along the passageway toward a separate rishut. That's fine. That's kosher. The question is, do Kohanim go directly right next to it? I was told they don't. I'm sure there's some who do. But according to this approach, that you can, the problem was you'd have to find your way through the, but if there's a path, I guess maybe the Kohanim could go. If there's no overhangs and it's, they could find a way in. But according to this opinion, this Kabbalistic shared by a number of Mekubalim, I don't know how many mainstream poskim, that a tzaddik is not matame, then you would go. There's a debate back and forth between Mordechai Eliyahu, as I recall, affirming this idea that Kohanim go to Kever Rachel. He says that's the tradition. And Rav Waldenberg, Saliezer, saying, well, we can't accept that. If you go to the Chasam Sofer's Kever, the Kohanim don't go in, but they've arranged in a way that the Kohanim could be on top and look down. David says, while we're justifiably shocked at the current situation between the two factions within Ponovej, how unprecedented is this, and how does this compare with the violent infighting that took place in Volozhin? I think there's a difference. I've never heard of a case in Volozhin where they physically attacked one of the rabbis. That I've never heard. They did other things. They, take that back. They did pour water on the Mashkiach once, but he's the Mashkiach. and they did do, but they, to attack, physically attack like this, I don't know. They made noise. They banged when Rechaim Berlin and others, they didn't accept it. They went on strike when the Mashkiach, when I think it was when Rechaim Berlin wanted to give a shiur, they banged, they closed their sfarim, they were mechutzafim, they were chutzpedik. But to physically, to pull the beer, to send the guy to the hospital, I don't know anything like that. Yes, the students fought sometimes. That we know. But I mentioned in one of my posts how, what's his name? The author of the book, Degel Machane Ruvain, I forget his name. He writes that he was a member of the Irgun when he was in the Chevron Yeshiva. And I think it was the Chevron Yeshiva. And a group of students once put a blanket over his head so he wouldn't see who it is and beat him up. Because he was, as a yeshiva bacher, he was also moonlighting in the Irgun. But you're always going to have teenagers. I mean, these are teenagers, remember. You're always going to have wild people do things like that. And Shmuley says the violence is probably not worse than Volozhin and Telsh. I don't think so. First of all, I don't know of any physical violence in Telsh. What they did is they... we do have violence. We have violence. So there's no question we had violence. But attacking the rabbis? If you find examples of it, yes, I don't know. Mel says, as I'm sure you remember, we were in Budapest and visited Hani Synagogue on Friday night. They did not play the organ because it was during the 3 weeks. Yes, it was very interesting that they're very makpid. They have a non-Jew to this day. They have a non, and to this day, the men and women don't sit together. Although they don't sit up in the balcony. They moved them down, but they sit separately. And they don't play the organ during the 3 weeks. And remember, this was with the Hector of Ramosha Kunitz, the rabbi of the Dohani today. He is a, if he was in America, he'd be a right-wing conservative. He is a very traditionalist, so much so that he would bring a group of Balabatim to go learn with the Orthodox rabbi. There's an those who are with me, you remember, oh, no, the year you were with me, Mel, I don't believe the rabbi was not in town. You were there with me the second year, I think, because I remember the Havdalah was done by I remember you were standing right next to the Satmar guy doing the Havdalah. In Budapest, even the Satmar Shochet and others, they can't wear strimals because it's a non-Hasidic place. But the very first year and the third year, the rabbi is there. So this is a Sanzer Chassid, a delightful man. He gave a shear to the non-Orthodox, which is very like Chabad sort of thing. And not, he wouldn't go to the Orthodox, but his to the Neolog, but the attitude was if the Neolog come to him, he'll give them a shear. So this guy, he's a traditionalist. The new Mikras Gadol, it's not really Mikras Gadol, it's called Otzar HaRishonim. It has a group of Rishonim that aren't usually found in the Chumash, and one of them is Yudah Chassid. Yes, thank you. Oh, Shmuley says it, thank you. Yes, I know. Some of the Chabad today don't have English. Correct. I there are some, and but traditionally they always did. So much so that Rav Menashe Klein has a tshuva in which he says that his son learns in Babov, but he says, but he makes sure to take his son out of this high school when they teach English. So even Babov had English. There's a guy, he wrote a book called Teacher, an Italian guy, about his experiences of teaching. I think it's in the Satmar school, so that they give them certain basic, maybe less now than in the past, but there was a time when the New York City actually enforced this. Maybe in future we will. The Litvish all have secular studies. If you're from the modern Orthodox world, they don't measure up. I get it. But my point only was to say that in, Tel's Yeshiva today has a high school, and they had a high school in Lithuania. Well, when they had a high school in Lithuania, they were the only one to have a high school in Lithuania. And that's the equivalent today of like the Neri Yisrael sending guys to Hopkins or Loyola, wherever they do college. So there's nothing unusual today for a Litvish Yeshiva high school to have secular studies. They all do. But so it's not really parallel. And finally, David says, is the reason that Lubavitch Kohani permit himself to go to the Rebbe's Kever, which I don't think they do, the mainstream, is because Kivrei Tzaddiki and Tamim, as per the Zohar, because the Rebbe didn't die. I think you'll have to ask the ones who do go, but the ones, when I was there, I asked, and I've subsequently asked, and I was told that they don't hold of it. Now, the guys in India, look, they can go, but I'm told they don't go at all because they don't think he's there, so there's no reason to go. And Shmuley says this is in jest. And Shmuley says to David, who asks him, are you asking in jest? He says, yes, it's based on the Zohar. Okay. But I want to get some, and I'll hear from our Chabad expert, Nachum Shmuel, next week. Really, are there any real Chabadnikim who hold this at all with the Lubavitch Rebbe? If you're going to hold it with anyone, you can hold it with the Lubavitch Rebbe. But it's not really mainstream. I don't know any Ashkenazi poskim will hold it. Okay, my friends, 9:48. We're going to have miss 1 week because of Shavuos. We will finish the book next week, God willing. The Tshuvot, that'll be 49, and the 50th class. Remember, I predicted the 50th class. Then we're going to do the appendix, although it might be more than 50 because it's more than. It's 15 pages, 17 pages of all sorts of interesting stuff. So it might take us another class, probably two classes with that. And then, soon we'll be able to levarech ha-mugmar, as they say, but there's still lots of interesting stuff to do. I won't see you next week because of Shavuos. Rabbi Kelman, take it away.
Of course, as we all many of the Reform shuls, the modern Reforms, also had a machitza, or at least had separate seating. That was not.
The mixed seating synagogues, the first seating synagogue was in America.
You're right.
Albany, New York, Isaac Mayer Wise. All the Reform synagogues in Germany had separate seating until the 20th century. They weren't necessarily, sometimes they were up in the gallery, other times they were in the same floor. But mixed seating is an American innovation. It's Minhag America.
If I'm not mistaken, J.J. Schechter, when he did this whole thing on Mechitza, told us there was a shul, some guy offered them like, the equivalent of $1 million if they would take, a Reform shul, if they would have mixed seating, and the shul said no, which is kind of astounding when you think of what, you know, how American Jewry all developed. But yes, okay, thank you very much. We look forward to seeing you in 2 weeks. We'll call the second one on the appendix 50A, or maybe we'll go over Sphere. And then, of course, afterwards, we're going to be starting a Shaul Lieberman, a series back to our sort of great rabbinic thinkers, you know, series. So that'll start.
And by the way, just to clarify, when I say Shaul Lieberman, it's not like a class on Geiger or Louis Ginsberg. The very issues we've been speaking about, the yeshiva world, orthodoxy in America, Torah literature, it'll be no different than the classes on the Gedolim, Shaul Lieberman. It's the same issues and the same personalities. Wait till you hear about the Chazon Ish and Shaul Lieberman.
They were cousins, no?
The first cousins, their mothers. Cousins.
Yeah. And of course, Shaul Lieberman married the Nitziv's granddaughter. He married Rav Meir Bar Ilan's daughter.
That was a second wife. He had a first marriage. We'll talk all this.
I don't know. Okay, that's okay. We'll have to come in here. Okay, we look forward. Want to wish you Chag Sameach, I guess. It's a week tonight, this second night of Shavuos. Those in Israel, one day we should have peace. Yontif, we should hear good news. Tomorrow we complete two of our sort of series between Pesach and Shavuot, Chassidut Wiskind and Megillat Rut by Ilana Goldstein. So that's tomorrow at 11 and 1:30. We'll look forward to learning with you and look forward to hearing from you. And everybody should be well and Laila Tov. And thank you very much. Good night, everybody. I hope to see people before Shavuos, but yes, okay, Chag Sameach. Yeah. Very nice. Yeah, for sure. Good Shabbos. Bye-bye. Be well.